Welcome to our program. I'm looking forward to sharing some conversations with you today, as always, so settle in. I'm Rhonda McBride. Coming up on Juno Afternoon, the sound of the eruption was heard all the way across the Pacific by Alaskans, but a group of Tongans here in Juno felt its impact. Also, homicide history from Juno's long-buried past. Ed Schoenfeld and Betsy Longenbaugh share some of their research into the Birdman of Alcatraz, a killer who attracted national attention. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm watch, which will remain in effect through late tomorrow night, with the possibility of atmospheric river conditions moving across southeast Alaska. Tonight, for Juneau and vicinity, expect mostly cloudy skies, lows in the lower 20s, east winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, we start out with snow in the forecast, with heavy accumulation expected from 2 to 6 inches, but it all turns to rain in the afternoon, highs in the mid-30s. Tomorrow night, not as cold, with lows in the mid-30s, both rain and snow in the forecast, the snow level at 800 feet. On Thursday, expect a steady diet of rain through Monday. Highs on Thursday around 40 degrees and continuing to remain in the lower 40s for the rest of the week. Lows in the mid to upper 30s. The sun rises tomorrow morning at 8:26 and sets at 3:50 in the afternoon. We have 7 hours and 20 minutes of daylight tomorrow.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are on the homelands of the Thlinkit. In the borough of Juno, we have the two Kwans, the Akwan and the Takukwan. KTOO studios sit on the ancestral home of the Hlinedi, or dog salmon people of the Akwan. We acknowledge those families of the Hlinedi who made use of these lands and waterways for thousands of years and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hansen Gress. Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha anikak. Gunnish cheese.
Cheesh for being here with us today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The latest aerial and satellite photos show that Tonga has been blanketed by ash after an underwater volcano erupted in an explosion that was heard as far away as Alaska. The country's government is now calling it an unprecedented disaster. KTOO's Rasha McChesney spoke with a group of Tongans living in Juno yesterday to find out how they're coping. This was before new details have emerged about the extent of the damage and the need for a massive disaster response.
The Pacific island of Tonga has been isolated from the rest of the world after a volcanic eruption that triggered a tsunami that cut off phone and internet. Ash from that eruption has been a major problem, and there are concerns of it contaminating fresh water supplies. And one other complication with aid efforts is that Tonga is currently COVID-19 free. I'm Rasha McChesney. I'm here today with Melehoko Pau'u Ma'ake, Margaret Sakona, Stephen Paya, and Vika Paya. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. You're all family and here in Juno. How's it going today? When was the last time that you heard from your family and friends in Tonga?
Mika, you want to answer that?
We're doing okay. We are still pretty much very concerned about our family and friends. We have not heard a single thing from anyone, and it's pretty devastating.
Some of the places where my mom come from, Ha'atafu, she has an auntie that they grew up there, has been completely damaged. And these are coastal area villages. And so we heard for sure that Ha'atafu severely damaged. And so that's the only information we've been able to get. So it's a good thing there is a High Commissioner of Australia and New Zealand there that has a satellite. Other than that, everyone's pretty much left in the dark, and we've been reaching out and no respond whatsoever. And we're not the only one. Even people who lives in New Zealand, which is a lot closer to Tonga, it's the same thing, which I've been talking a lot to one of my first cousin because of her dad, who's 84, who's there. And still they haven't heard anything. And he's actually in the capital of in Nuku'alofa. So still no communication from him. So we're all, pretty edgy to be able to hear from him that he's okay. And that he has a daughter that's also there, and they have a lot of little kids. So I want to turn some time over to Margaret and Stephen.
It's really scary. And, Tonga is a really small country, but the people, everybody's really passionate and they love big. And so it's really important for us what's going on to kind of have people be aware and get involved in any way possible. But I have a little cousin that lives with us. He's been living with us for a couple of years now, but he moved from Tonga. And his dad and his sister are living there right now. And we speak to them every single week. But ever since the volcano erupted and everything went downhill over there in Tonga, we haven't been able to hear anything. We've been trying to call them, message them, and reach out to family and friends out there. But we haven't been able to get any kind of information except for what we've been able to read and see on the from the media. And it's a sad thing because sometimes we've even gotten misformed information too from the media. So I remember, like, my mom's village, the place where she's from, some people said it like completely sunk, but that was like, it was false. And so, like, for us right now, we're just like completely in the dark with everything. And that's just been, it's just been devastating all around. But that's the last we've been able to hear from family, is really just right before the volcano erupted.
Margaret, do you mind if I ask, it's been really tricky to get updates. Like, I've been checking, news sources in New Zealand and Australia, and it seems like international news was talking about it for a while, and then it just kind of went silent. And I'm curious, I've been checking sort of individual people's social media to see who might be posting. And I'm wondering how you're getting your updates, if you're sort of crawling family members' social media, if you're calling them, how are you trying to make contact?
I've been literally going to any kind of source possible, like media. And then if I don't get enough from the media, then I've been having so many family and friends message me, send me information, like videos, pictures from other people's accounts. And so that's how I've been able to keep updated with what's going on. But still, even that kind of information is still not enough. And it's been really hard not hearing, being able to hear from anyone on the island. Because even from New Zealand and Australia, we know that they've been, waiting to kind of go in and help out. But because we've heard that it's still pretty active, the volcano, mm-hmm. They're trying to be really cautious about going in anytime soon too. So. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's how I've heard a lot of my information is really from people's personal accounts.
Yeah, I want to clarify one thing. One thing that I've also noticed, because I've been doing the same thing, is going to many people's accounts. And to me, it seems like all those informations is from before. It was like from right before that eruption happened. I can't sleep very well lately. And so that's because that's what I'm doing. I'm just like, you know, trying to get any information, and look like every information that I'm getting, it's right before it happened. Just like my really good friend, when she did her video of driving home from when the, during that eruption. So I kind of know how, you know, the land was looking like, and what with the water. And there was a video that got sent from Avika's auntie that we've just been sharing. I've been sharing around. And so, but it looked like all of that information was pretty much before, I mean, you know, yeah, before the internet went completely down in the phone and all of that.
Yeah, so I grew up in the islands in Tonga, and I moved here like right before my last year of in high school. So I kind of have an idea of what, you know, the life was when I, you know, when I grew up. So I can't imagine, you know, going through with what these kids and, you know, because 30% of, you know, the income that Tonga, island of Tonga makes is from agriculture. And, you know, when I grew up over there, we always go to have our plantation. We always outside, like majority of the time. The only time we're in the house, we go to sleep or, you know, and then after that, we go outside. So now I can't imagine, like, you know, your house is like 2 or 3 feet with water and you can't do anything, you know. So that's what I kind of, you know, thinking about is like what Mela said. We all we've seen videos of what happened before the, you know, the tsunami. So this is very sad, you know. So I haven't heard from my sister, you know. And another thing too, we haven't talked about was when I grew up over in Tonga, we study the you know, what the islands are like in Tonga. And the main island is Tongatapu, where it's very flat. There's no map, like no mountains. So with, and we always joke about it, there's a tsunami come, it's gonna wipe out the whole islands. And there's about majority, I think it was like 70,000 live in that island. So I can't imagine 70,000 people with a tsunami warning cramped up in the little village that's trying to find the highest places.
I read that Tongatapu, like the highest point above sea level is like 76 feet or something like that. Like, it's just not a very, there's not a lot of high ground.
Yeah, that's why we're surprised that, you know, why is the whole, why, you know, the island still an island, you know, it should have been underwater already, but that's what we're waiting to see. So
it sounds like you're saying it would be really difficult to be prepared for something at this scale.
One thing I noticed on the videos that I was being sent to is the awareness of volcano. What is a volcano eruption? What happens when a volcano erupts? I kept hearing, you know, the lady who was taking the video, like, why is it the rocks? Why is it raining rocks? Why is it the rain is dark? Why is there so much dust? I think that's like the number one thing that really blew me away was hearing, yeah, because these people have no idea. They have never experienced or even educated, or like here in America, you know, in the schools, we're taught like what you do in an earthquake, how you prepare, or, you know, you go under a table. There's not any kind of awareness.
I think it has more to do with they really didn't know that a volcano was erupting. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they understand what a volcano is, but I don't think they had a warning like early on enough to be able to be prepared. Okay, there's a volcano about to erupt. You guys have to go to your safe spaces. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. I know, like, I always heard stories of my dad saying, like Benny was talking about, like they had tsunamis all the time. But mm-hmm. what some of them had to do was they would run to some of the church buildings, mm-hmm. and there was certain places, locations that they would have designated just for people to go to. Because mm-hmm. I know that like a lot of homes are right next to the coastline and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so right. They would have to have other places to relocate. But I honestly feel like they didn't have a warning like sent to them saying like, hey, something's about to happen. You know what I mean? Cause then I would probably do the same. Like, what the heck are all the rocks falling from? Like, cause I didn't, and it was underneath, the volcano was underwater. So I would be super confused if I didn't see a volcano.
And how are your friends and neighbors in Juneau helping you specifically? Like, what do you want them to know? And are they supporting you? And how can they support you in this going forward?
To me, it's the awareness. It's really important with Tonga's situation. And I have amazing friends who are here from Juneau who's already, you know, who called me and checked up on me and my family to see if I had made any communication. So those are like the first questions that I'm getting, you know, from my friends here in Juneau, you know, so it's really nice, you know, to hear them, you know, that they care, that they, you know, that they know, because, you know, the Tongan, you know, like you kind of have a feeling, you know, feeling for it, Rasha. In our culture, in the Tongan culture, it's like, you know, it's almost like we're all, you know, we're all family and we're all in it together.
Actually, just yesterday, a really good friend of mine, all the way, she lives all the way in Florida. She reached out to me and asked me, she said, hey, how are your family? How's everyone doing? And you know, it kind of shocked me because I'm like, wow, even my friend who lives all the way in Florida, like she knows about this. And it's very comforting to know that people do care. And, you know, she reposted and shared a lot of things on the media. And that's something I think a lot of people can maybe continue to do is just kind of share that with everyone else. That way everyone else is aware of what's going on. There are people who are going through a very hard time right now, and anything that, you know, prayers, it doesn't have to be something, even just a prayer, saying a prayer or sending love and good light to others would be a great thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Vika and Mele. My input on this is, you know, I want everyone to share. Most people don't know about, you know, the islands and what's going on. And the more people, you know, learn about it, they, you know, they can help in any way. And not only that, I feel like my part, I don't know if you know my background, but I used to play professional football, and I'll be, be selfish of me if I don't reach out to my teammates and former teammates and coaches in this special organization. It's a billion-dollar organization. They help this kind of circumstances, especially for Tonga, and especially with so many Tongan Polynesian and NFL and then other sports. I think that's gonna be my side that I can help share the message, you know, and I already told my wife that, you know, I don't mind going and help because you know, watching those videos, those kids in Tonga, and I have to, I can't imagine my kids, you know, I can't imagine myself going up there, you know, and going through that. So that's going to be my mission in the next year or two, to help out as much as I can, you know, and just to spread those messages with everyone. It'll be selfish if you're a Tongan and you don't get to help out because you don't see anything. You don't get to experience anything in Tonga. But like Mele said, we're all families, and I'm already emotional just watching those videos, and I try to hide it from my wife this morning when she was watching, just looking at me when I was watching the videos, but I actually was teared up because there's nowhere to hide in Tonga. You know, if that tsunami come and wipe out the whole island, is like, where are you going to go hide? You know, so, but the damages after that for the next, two, five, 10 years is going to be bad.
They're lucky to have you on their side, Stephen.
One thing that I love about Tonga and that's so beautiful about the country is that they're a religious country. So if you're ever in Tonga, like, you know, like on a Sunday, you know that all businesses are closed down and there's no businesses that are allowed to run on Sunday. That one day is everything is shut down. You're spending time at church or with family. Prayer is a big deal to us Tongan people. So if people can pray for us at this time, especially with not knowing where to, where we can send our resources and our, you know, people wanting to help out in any way. I think the biggest help we could receive at this time is really praying, because like I said, religion and God is everything to us Tongans.
Mele Hoko, I think this is a good time for me to play that song that you sent me. Is there anything that you want people to know about that song before we jump right into it?
Yeah, actually that song go okuyai aiki. It's a song about Tonga, and it's like almost the national song of Tonga. Of course, we have our national song with our king, but this is a song that when you play this song, it talks about the little island, a little period that's so tiny that is in the ocean. And how us Tongan people, you know, what a blessing that we have that to, you know, grow up in such a beautiful little island. And we are very proud of it. We are very proud people. And we shall rise and we will come together in this difficult time. And we will.
Mele Hoko, Vika, Stephen, Margaret, thank you so much for joining me and giving so much of yourselves today. I really appreciate it. And we will all be hoping and pulling for you that you'll hear from your friends and loved ones soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rasha.
Thank you.
Bye.
thanks to Rasha McChesney for bringing this conversation and the request for our prayers to Juneau Afternoon. Rasha is the daily editor for KTOO News. Up next, you'll hear about cold cases in Juneau that are really, really cold by more than 100 years, but really, really hot on the lecture circuit. We'll find out why when we come back. This is Juneau Afternoon. Thank you for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. We are going to travel back in time today with the help of Betsy Longenbaugh and her husband, Ed Schoenfeld. And they have a rule. They don't deal with recent murders, but focus their research on cases that went cold decades ago. But that still hasn't affected the popularity of their lectures and walking tours in downtown Juneau to revisit old crime scenes. It also doesn't hurt that their lecture series comes with dessert, starting this Saturday. Now, it was scheduled to be held in person at McPheeters Hall at Holy Trinity Church, but COVID has moved the program entirely online. But still, it's likely to be sold out. I talked with the two yesterday about one of Juneau's most notorious killers, Robert Stroud, the Birdman of Alcatraz, and about why their lecture series is so popular. The good news is that your tickets sell out quickly once you announce a show. But the bad news is a lot of people get frustrated because they want to see your show.
I think that's true. I'm very gratified that it's such a popular topic and that we seem to be popular presenters. I'm sometimes a little surprised. I always worry that we're not going to do well, and then we always do better than well. So that's very gratifying. And I know it's frustrating for people, especially in Juneau, because we tend to do things at the last minute. I've been involved over the years with lots of presentations and fundraising events, and it always seemed that people waited till the last minute to get their tickets. So I think it's especially frustrating for folks who are used to waiting till the last minute, and they wait till the last minute, or even what they think isn't the last minute, and there are no tickets left. So that's too bad.
Your next program is a very popular subject, the Birdman of Alcatraz, Robert Stroud's story. He committed that murder that sent him to Leavenworth here in Juneau. And of course, those tickets got zipped up right away. Are you going to look at doing that virtually? Because you had talked about that as a possibility.
Yes, we are. And, you know, obviously due to the increase in COVID cases in Juneau, and it's still headed up. So we think the only safe way to do it, despite all the precautions we planned, requiring vaccines and masks and all that. So we will do it over Zoom, and we will let everybody know who has tickets. We will still have the desserts, and people can pick them up beforehand. So if anybody already has a ticket who's listening, we'll be sending them details about that. Hopefully the other two shows we have planned for March 5th and April 2nd, we'll be able to do in person.
So why is it you think that there's such a demand for your programs? Because these are deaths of yesteryear.
Actually, they really are of yesteryear. We focus on the period between around 1900 and 1960, so they're almost all pre-statehood. And I suspect it's a combination of things. It's a lot about Juneau and Douglas history. So if you are new to town or even have been here for a very long time, it's kind of fun to look at a different facet of the history through the eyes of true crime and the sorts of things that were going on. But I personally find it interesting because of the puzzle. Most of the cases that I've written about and that we present have a solution to them. Not all of them, but most of them. And following the process of the police discovering who it was who did the crime and sort of second guessing them onto whether they made a decision or not is for me part of the fascination of telling these stories.
Well, a lot of people probably find the characters the murderers themselves fascinating. And of course, who could be more fascinating than Robert Stroud because of his personality? I mean, he was a murderer, yet he was an amazing researcher and learned a lot about birds.
Yeah, he was basically kind of a street urchin grown up, got into drugs and prostitution, and really couldn't make a living, but ended up in the prison system and started reading and had the intelligence to be able to do something with that. So he became an expert on a lot of things.
Do you think the paradox of someone being a murderer, but also someone who becomes an accomplished bird researcher is just fascinating to people?
Yes, I do. And one thing to note is, though, I was really very surprised when I moved to Juneau and discovered that the Birdman of Alcatraz originated his life of crime in Juneau. Most of the people, the younger people, certainly on our walking tours, when we talk about the story, have never heard of the Birdman of Alcatraz. So it really is a function of a time when both the book and the movie were very well known nationally. And that time, sadly, is past. So that story of somebody who's been supposedly reformed through his academic and intellectual pursuits is a really interesting story. What's even more interesting that we've discovered as we dig into this, that he really wasn't reformed at all. He was a very egotistical person who had a very high opinion of himself and was extremely good at selling it. There's lots of dispute over his actual ability as an ornithologist now, but at the time people thought he was the bee's knees, and he may have been to some degree, but to a large degree, he was a plagiarist and somebody who was a self-promoter. And his mother, the woman who he decided to call his wife, jumped on board that boat, as did in later years his brother. So he had a lot of outside help in promoting him that benefited the people who promoted him.
Often what people learned about him was through his mother, because she was more than happy to grant interviews to people all over the place to pretty much convince them that, you know, my poor boy, he did bad things, but he's a better person now. And look how much he's helped the bird fanciers, and look how much he's helped people solve diseases of canaries and other birds. But in fact, throughout all of this, he was somebody who he wrote extensively. And he talked about killing people. He talked about who he wanted to kill and how he'd do it. He also wrote child pornography. He was a child abuser, or wanted to be. He wasn't some saintly person. And that's the interesting conflict here, the myth and the legend and the truth of the Birdman of Alcatraz, is that the movie Birdman of Alcatraz and the book was based on is a very romanticized version of what happened. And there's another book out there called The Many Faces of the Birdman of Alcatraz, or of Robert Stroud anyway, that basically picks that apart and uses court documents, statements in the record, prisons records and other things to kind of pick that apart. So, well, he did do some very interesting things. He wasn't that great person a lot of people thought he turned into.
No matter what time you live in, truth is always elusive, isn't it? But perhaps this would be a good time to play some of the movie trailer from The Birdman of Alcatraz, starring Burt Lancaster, because it is way over the top. Let's listen.
Robert Stroud, American, a convict, a paradox of a man who has lived in an aura of violence, yet who, out of defiance and sheer strength of will, taught himself in a prison cell half a dozen languages, and mastered the intricacies of a score of scientific subjects. An accomplishment to stagger the imagination.
You think Stroud's quite a man, don't you?
I think he's a genius.
Robert Stroud, American, genius, a convict.
So the movie pretty much turns him into a hero. How does that jive with your research?
One thing to note is that although the public liked to see him as a reformed character who had developed this incredible intellectual capacity, prison officials were never deceived. He was not allowed to be interviewed by anyone, including the author of The Birdman of Alcatraz. No one ever interviewed him. He never read the book, and he was forbidden to see the film because really the prison officials despised him, probably unfairly so. He wasn't actually in solitary confinement as much as, again, were portrayed in the book and the movie. And part of the reason that he was kept in solitary confinement and part of the reason that the prison officials despised him so is because he was an openly gay man in a time that was decades before it wasn't considered a crime in many states to even have a gay relationship. So the fact that he was so openly gay, he was considered, quote, degenerate by prison officials, and they believed it was for his safety and the safety of the other prisoners that he was kept in segregation for so much of his prison life. So on one hand, the prison officials were right in talking about the sort of manipulative, egotistical sociopath that he was. So on the other hand, they definitely saw him as a degenerate because he was gay. And so he was a victim of what we would call now a really outdated mindset and a very prejudicial one.
When the murder happened in Juneau, he was a pimp, right?
Right. That's absolutely right. But the book talks about the fact this woman was his girlfriend, and people at the time, there didn't seem to be any doubt that they had had a relationship that was an intimate one, but he was also extremely young. He was 18 years old when he killed this person. He turned 19 10 days after the murder in jail, and he never left jail again. But he was also seen as a victim of this older prostitute.
So could you take us back to the beginning and give us the story of the actual murder?
I can, sure. What actually took place was he had procured clients for his girlfriend. Kitty O'Brien was her prostitute name. Her real name possibly was Kate Delaney, but we're not sure of that either. And he procured a client who was a bartender at a local saloon. And the agreement was the bartender would spend the night with Kitty. She would go to his house and spend the night with him. And in return, he would pay her $10, which was probably about the going rate. It's about $300 today's terms. So she did. She spent the night with him, left around 5 o'clock in the morning on a Monday morning, July 18th, 1909, and went back to the room that she and Robert Stroud were sharing and told Robert Stroud he'd shorted her, he'd given her $1 instead of 10, and to go kill him. And Robert Stroud obligingly took the dollar, bought bullets for the gun that they apparently had, went to the guy's house and shot him twice in the head. And then as he walked out of the house, he saw there were two eyewitnesses to this murder. So he walked down the street to the Valentine Building, which is still in downtown Juneau. It now holds Juneau Drug, and saw in the window, this is my supposition. What we do know is he turned himself into the police chief who happened to be at the Valentine Jewelry Store. I think he walked down the street, saw the guy in the window, decided to just walk in and turn himself in because he knew there were eyewitnesses. And just to give you an idea of how destitute the two of them were, when they arrested him and took him to the jail, the first thing they did was make him strip and burn all his clothes. Forensic evidence, anyone? And take a bath, because they were convinced, and it was probably true, he had what they called vermin, what we would probably today call lice. He was probably completely louse infected, and they didn't want him to affect the rest of the inmates. He was also emaciated. He was a 6 foot tall guy who at that point weighed less than 130 pounds. So I think he and Kitty were really skating on the edge of complete destitution.
They obviously weren't very successful at prostitution. And we've done a lot of research on the sex trade in the mining days, early Juneau, because there were quite a number of victims who were prostitutes. And some of them, a lot of them that we read about, were independent businesswomen. They didn't have a pimp. They procured people on their own, often just by sitting in the window of their little crib, their little cabin, in their underwear, which was covered up more than a lot of clothes do today, but it was a different era. And they had wealth, they accumulated wealth, and they were the ones that we researched were killed because of their wealth, generally. That was not the case with Kitty O'Brien and Robert Stroud. They were just barely getting by. You know, for whatever reason, they were not successful, independent business people.
Kitty was quite a bit older than him, right?
Part of the myth, the newspaper account at the time indicates she was about 30.
And so, he was 18.
Yeah. So older. And I think the reason that he was able to plead to manslaughter instead of first degree murder, which sure sounds like it was first degree murder, was because people felt sympathy for him as the victim of this hardened, been around the town a few times prostitute. She was not portrayed at all sympathetically. She was described as both a dope fiend, which today we'd call an opium addict, and a drunkard. So that certainly helped him, as well as the fact that his mother, who lived in Seattle, hopped on the first boat as soon as she could with a lawyer in tow, showed up and sat holding his hand through every court hearing, glaring at Kitty O'Brien throughout. So I think that could have done nothing but created sympathy for him as the victim of this horrific older woman who turned him to the dark side. And that was the story that his mother loved to tell too.
Well, it's so interesting that a child of a mother who obviously loved him so much went so wrong.
Well, there's a backstory, of course. There's always a backstory. He had a physically abusive father, and his mother, probably in response to that, was emotionally manipulative and sometimes abusive. His father did not want him to be born and actually tried to get his mother to get an abortion. That didn't happen, and so he ignored the child, just pretended he wasn't there, even left the home for a while. Starting around the age of 2, according to the best researcher we found on the topic, she started telling him that his father had not wanted him to be born. There were many other cases she pitted the siblings against each other and against their father. And, you know, certainly nothing in the ballpark of beating up kids. The beatings slowed down a bit after Robert Stroud was old enough to fight back and broke a couple of his dad's ribs.
I do think that both Elizabeth Stroud, his mother, and Robert Stroud loved drama and loved agitation and were very, very good at manipulating people. So whether she came up to save him in an effort to, because she loved him, or she came up to be part of what she saw as an exciting drama, is definitely debatable.
Boy, there is a lot of fodder there for psychiatrists to probe. So yes. If the initial crime that sent him to Leavenworth happened in Juneau, why didn't he wind up in jail in Alaska?
It was all federal charges, and people didn't get sent to long-term prison here. They got sent actually to McNeil Island Penitentiary in Washington State, and he was there for a couple of years till he caused all sorts of trouble and stabbed somebody. And then he got sent off to Leavenworth, where he committed his second murder, went into total isolation, and started researching and studying birds.
You call him a master manipulator, so I presume that he could be very charming when he wanted to be.
Some people describe him that way. And the second book that we've read, the one about the many faces of Robert Stroud, the author interviewed a lot of people who knew him, guards and other prisoners. And they're very differing accounts of him as a person. Some people just found him despicable from the first time they ever met him, and others found him really charming and interesting and fun to talk to. So I think he did have many faces. And I think it did depend on what he thought that person could do for him.
And I mean, he was smart in how he did this. Of course, he had very little contact with people, but he was allowed to write letters. So he corresponded with dozens of bird fanciers before it really became famous. And on paper, he was a charmer and appeared to be very knowledgeable. So that all, I think, contributed to his ability to manipulate people.
But there's that paradox of someone who could intensely care for birds and have that kind of compassion to heal them to somebody who, if you got him angry, would turn around and stab you.
Yeah, and I'm not sure he really had compassion for birds. I think it was more of an intellectual pursuit. I think it was more of like, why is this bird sick? One of the things, most disgusting things I've read about, and this is obviously true because it pops up again and again, when he dissected birds, he dissected them with his fingernails.
Oh.
So I think because he didn't have tools, and he actually describes in one of his recommends actually to bird owners that they do their own dissecting of their dead bird when something happens so they can try to figure out what happened to it. And he suggests using their fingernails. So I'm not sure whether he really ever saw them as a pet and became emotionally attached to them as much as he became sort of intellectually attached to the idea of solving the puzzle of their illness.
Such a waste, though, of brain power.
Absolutely.
To be tied up into this pathology that he had.
Oh, yeah. You know, after the birds are gone, he's not allowed birds anymore in Alcatraz. He decided at age 50, I think he was about 54 when he went to Alcatraz, he decided to take up studying languages and apparently became fluent in French and learned also Spanish and Italian, taught himself. And that to me is just a remarkable accomplishment with no audio tapes, right? Or certainly videotapes. So he would have had to teach himself to be fluent in a language with a written word only. So I think there's no doubt the guy was very, very smart. Whether he was as smart as he thought he was, I don't know. He was also, like I say, extremely manipulative. And fellow prisoners talked about his ability to agitate and his delight in doing so. He loved to create chaos in the world around him and was very good at it.
Interesting, because he didn't have much experience in the actual world beyond 19.
That's right. And one of the things that this my supposition is there were many efforts. He and his mother went through enormous efforts to try to get him released from jail, petition after petition after petition sent to federal officials and senators and anybody who they thought would listen, including at one point Senator McCarthy, who he saw as a sympathetic to his cause, was absolutely not. And in all of that, when they did try to talk to him about parole or leaving the prison, he made his demands about the conditions of his leaving so rigorous that there was no way he would ever be given parole. For example, he demanded that if he be released from jail, he never have to tell anybody where he was going, that he'd have complete free rein of his travels and his activities. He didn't want any oversight at all. And that was so unrealistic that I can't help but think he did not want to leave jail, and why would he? He had three hots and a cot from a person who before that really had not, and the ability to continue academic pursuits unfettered, and was able to, through his writing these books, and he continued writing up to his death, able to create a certain amount of fame and acclamation. So I think it really worked to his advantage to be in jail as long as he was, in a weird kind of way.
Maybe something he wasn't conscious of, or maybe he was. It's hard to say. That was a strange brain. And I guess maybe that's what fascinates us, is how people can be many things at once.
Yeah.
I think there's only one other character we've come across in our murder research. Tell me if I'm wrong, Betsy, but who comes close to this level of sophistication, probably goes beyond it. And that was Alaska's first serial killer. And we did a big presentation on him a couple of years ago. And before coronavirus, he was somebody who got away with basically going around Southeast Alaska, killing people. And he was very good at figuring out people who wouldn't be missed until he wasn't.
Yeah.
But that's another story.
And you have many other stories to tell. And I hope that what can happen is that you can come back to our program and give us sort of the short course on some of these murders that you've looked into. So what's coming up in your series?
Well, our next show after Saturdays will be March 5th, Dismemberment in Sitka, and April 2nd, Death Comes to the Douglas Underworld. There was quite an underworld in Douglas, as there was in Juneau. In fact, I can look out my window and see the street where the prostitutes' cribs used to be, at least one of the streets where they used to be. There were quite a few. And those shows, assuming we can do it safely, will be 3 to 5 in the afternoon at McPeters Hall, Holy Trinity Church. And this is a benefit for the church. It's the church we attend, and we usually do other things to raise money that you can't do during COVID. We had done these presentations for the Juneau Douglas City Museum before, and they went across well. And we still do our murder tours through them, or will be this summer. we don't make any money off this. Somebody asked me that a while back, and I said, we lose money. But that's not why we do them.
Well, it takes a lot of work to dig this information out. And from some of the things I've seen before, I see that you've gone into old records and have scraps of police blotters and all kinds of records that must be really hard to track down at this point.
Sometimes it is. And sometimes, I mean, the more we do it, of course, the easier it becomes. Sometimes as we're looking through, say, court records over at the state archives, we'll come across a story we didn't know, or an addition to a story that we did know. And that can be pretty exciting. So the research, Ed and I've guessed somewhere between 100 and 200 hours per presentation. So it is an awful lot of work, but it is enjoyable. And I feel like we're learning so much, not just about that particular puzzle of that particular crime, but about the town. And so for us, who we live in Douglas, we walk in Douglas every day with our dog. And it, for me, it has really changed how I see where I'm living. When I walk through the woods where the Treadwell mine was, I take the same footsteps that one of our very first murder victims and murderers walked. And so that lends a certain amount of richness to everything that we do over here. And I hope we can portray that. I was excited when we did our last Douglas walking tour in September, and it was a beautiful day, which was a little unusual for walking tours. It would seem to be on rainy days. And at the end of the tour, some of the younger couples who were on the walk wanted to know about some other locations in the area. Where was this building and what happened there? And that was what was exciting to me, is to think this excitement that I have about the early history of this booming town of Douglas and the amazing gold mining town of Treadwell is being shared through our walking tours. And so it was very fun to say, you know, if you want to see where the first open pit mine was, you go up that hill and you can see it. It's still there. So for me, that's what's made all of this a little more fun.
Well, it kind of reminds me of that movie, The Sixth Sense, where the little boy sees people that have died. And so, you know, the road has accident victims, you know, that died.
There is a little aspect to that, especially in downtown Douglas. Now that we created a Douglas walking tour this past summer. So places, like I say, that we walk every day, I'm now seeing in a whole different light. It was very much of a wide open town that was serving people who worked at Treadwell Mine. It didn't have access to bars and prostitutes and churches, as Ed always points out, which was, all of those were in Douglas. So Douglas was definitely the site of extracurricular activity on the part of all those thousands of miners.
I'm curious, do you research any of the history of the Native communities that lived in Douglas?
As best
yes,
we can.
We do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously we're focusing on crime, on murders, and there certainly were those, but there's several cases that are part of our Douglas murder tour that have victims who lived in the Indian village, and the racial dynamics and how law enforcement treated those people is very much a part of that story. In our overall research, I am guessing that there were cases that never went through the courts or never ended up in a court file or a newspaper article, because a lot of people at that time didn't think Native people were important, which of course, you know, was absolutely racist. In a town like Douglas, where the city burnt down a village to build a boat harbor less than 60 years ago. Anyway, that isn't surprising. It is disgusting, but we look for those cases and try to put them into context.
Well, it's interesting that murders are an avenue to all kinds of history that we've forgotten.
They really are. One of my favorite stories, and to me, well, I'll tell you about the story. It was a story of a man who walked into, about 10 o'clock one night, walked into a busy bar and grill in downtown Juneau in the 1930s. And without even taking the gun out of his pocket, killed a man with 5 shots. He took the gun out of his pocket for the last 2 shots, but the rest went right through the pocket. Killed him in front of this restaurant full of witnesses, and he was not convicted. He was found not guilty for reasons of self-defense. And I puzzled and puzzled over this, because the victim was a well-known gun runner, but the murderer was an African-American man. And I thought, how in the world did somebody who was Black in Juneau in the 1930s get away with murder like that? Well, it turned out not only was the victim somebody who was considered a man of low character, but the murderer was the town barber.
So he was having a haircut.
Again, having grown up in a little town, I thought that's how he got away with it. He knew everybody's secrets. He was a town barber. And how many barbers could there have been in a town as small as Juneau was at the time? So yeah, I think he was a very sympathetic defendant.
And probably well-liked. I mean,
yes.
I can't think of anyone that's cut my hair in recent times that I haven't really liked.
Right, that you've had have a personal connection to, right?
Right. So before we go, I do want to ask you about the book you have coming out.
Well, thank you. So after we did our presentations 2 years ago for the City Museum, I came home after we did the first presentation and wrote my first chapter because I just felt I knew the story so well. And then the second presentation, I did the same, and the third, I did the same. And then I identified seven other stories. So the book has a total of 10 chapters. Each chapter is a different story. The first story happened in 1902 and the last one in 1956, the first murder and the last murder. So they're sequential.
So what's the title?
Forgotten Murders, Historic Murders from Juneau, Alaska's Capital City, something like that. I haven't seen the cover yet, but it's supposed to be coming out in late spring. Epicenter Press is publishing it, and I'm excited about it coming out. I'm hoping that we could do a second book on murder stories out of Southeast Alaska.
And woven into all of those tales are more than murders. And I guess that's kind of what makes it fascinating. So if we missed your lectures, at least we can have your book.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm hoping so. I'm excited about it eventually coming out and excited about starting research on the next one, which is I'm already finding some really fascinating stories. So yay.
And once it's out, we will be doing, I think, some readings. Well, Betsy will be doing some readings. Probably a book tour around Southeast Alaska. And we've also talked a lot about doing a podcast. So that may also happen. I hope it does.
Now, if you want to find out more about how to get tickets for the Death with Dessert series, which I point out comes with cake from Treadwell Kitchens, all you have to do is go to the Juneau Holy Trinity Church website. That's www.trinityjuneau.org. www.trinityjuneau.org. Shelley Delaney will be your host for tomorrow on Juneau Afternoon. Some of the conversations she'll have on tap: the Inspiring Girls Expedition, Juneau Youth Services, Big Brothers and Big Sisters, as well as a chance to get to meet the new Dean of Arts and Sciences at the University of Alaska Southeast. That will do it for Juneau Afternoon, broadcast from Tlingit Ani on KTOO 104.3 FM. Juneau Afternoon airs live at 3, Tuesday through Friday, and repeats at 7 o'clock. You can also listen online at ktoo.org. Juneau Afternoon is a production of the KTOO Arts and Culture Team, which includes Shelley Delaney, KXLL's Chandra Boom, and the leader of our team, Cheryl Snyder. Until next time, thanks for joining the conversation. From all of us at KTOO, gunach chish. Have a good evening.